Pastor Mai, hello and welcome to this edition of Agenda. I'm Ewan Gorn. Was Cam Lorke saved from development? And if so, for how long? We speak to the campaigners who made sure Strang and Union Mills weren't connected by new estates and get their reflections on the final Eastern Area Plan, which goes to Tynwald this week. As well as that, politicians' pay is up for debate. We find out if this restructure will cost the taxpayer more. Those who successfully campaigned to stop development between Union Mills and the Strang are warning the public must pay close attention to future area plans. Ken Kinraid and John Kermode argued against building on four fields at Camlork Farm as part of the Eastern Area Plan process. The document, which goes before Tynwald for approval this week, would pave the way for more than 1,000 new homes to be built across the east. With area plans also set for the north and the west, the pair say it's vital people take part in the process. So what do they think of the final area plan? And what have they learned from the process? What wisdom can they impart? These are questions I put to both John and Ken.
The original Camlork site, which is sited to the west of Strang Road and Union Mills. Strang Road runs between Union Mills and the Strang, and it's an area of farmland. And this particular development site that was originally proposed consists of about four fields, about 50 acres in total. And anything up to 500 houses could have been built on that land if approval had been given.
So one of the unusual things about the whole site was it would have been the first time, we think, in the island's history that development would have obliterated two communities and just overwritten them with housing. And we felt that was just fundamentally wrong.
So this would have merged Union Mills and the Strang?
That's right.
But it didn't, or hasn't, yet. There was a huge process around this plan, and you were both involved at the inquiry stage. So you put your argument out there, didn't you?
We did, certainly did, on a number of points, some of which we could go through. One of which, the main one that I was dealing with, was the agricultural land and the quality of that land. When the planning policy team in the Cabinet Office looked at this site originally, they downgraded it to being unremarkable, shall we say. And yet some of this land on Camlork Farm is amongst some of the best in the Isle of Man. It's amongst the top 5% of the agricultural land that's in the Isle of Man. And yet they were quite happy for it to be concreted over. So that was the first really big one that we worked on. And fortunately, the planning inspector agreed with us in respect of three fields. But one other, he did say, might be suitable as a strategic reserve.
Now, is that a success? Do you think when you started this protest or process, if you like, can you consider this a victory?
A number of good points within this. You know that they have avoided the coalescence of Strang and Union Mills. It's much more restricted. The reservations we have are some of the points around that, and perhaps of wider importance and interest for the island as well. One of those is everything is predicated on population numbers and population growth. Mm. And whilst there's the enthusiasm that the population needs to grow, the reality is that effectively the population has flatlined from 2011 to now. It's virtually no change.
But why does that matter? I mean, don't we just need an area plan so people have a clear idea, developers and the public have a clear idea of what could be used? Because nobody's saying the strategic reserve sites, for example, are going to be used until we reach a certain level of growth anyway. So doesn't that reassure you?
To some extent it does, but the strategic reserve sites can be released by Cabinet Office effectively. And our major concern is that if it's strategic, it really ought to perhaps be going to Tynwald as a whole rather than being dependent on perhaps an individual minister or a couple of ministers, because they could be much more subject to pressure. Mm.
They do have to justify why they're doing it, though, don't they?
They do, but I think that's important that politicians are held accountable for exactly that. and that that decision is more public than in a quiet room somewhere in quiet discussions with developers about what they would like to see happening. One of the values of the public inquiry is it is in public. It allows all of the arguments to be exercised and for the outcome to be seen and debated by Tynwald. We would strongly like the release of strategic reserves also to be a matter for Tynwald debate and approval rather than we will give it through structures and almost secondary legislation or even policy, which we don't think is strong enough.
Would you agree, Ken? Have you got anything to add on that?
I would. I'd just like to say that I think it's important that any policy decisions are made on evidence. And what we're short of here is evidence. The whole current area plan for the East was predicated on figures that were outdated and clearly incorrect.
Well, hang on, they did get modified, though, didn't they?
It did get modified, but we wouldn't have been in this position had they not decided to go forward with a review of the strategic plan and basically leave the numbers as they were from 2011. Hmm. When they knew, if they'd have waited just a few more months, they could have had accurate information from the 2016 census. And what worries us, I think, also is the fact that if we've got these release mechanisms for the for the strategic reserve sites now, why aren't we able to wait for the census in 12 months' time? Mm. We're only 12 months away from the next census. Why don't we wait now and find out what the actual numbers are?
Well, why do you think they're not waiting? Is this a political reason, an economic reason? What's the reason?
Well, I hope it's not the fact that there's an election next year. But I think
you wouldn't
also
be so cynical, would you?
I couldn't possibly comment. But I think there is also the issue that the developers are wanting to press on. We've seen a number of developments, particularly in the south and more recently in the north even, where developers are now putting forward applications for large numbers of houses, which appear to be getting sold, which are all on greenfield sites, and which I think, and probably several of other of our group would think, is going to help to hollow out even more of Douglas and the surrounding towns.
But this is about money. I mean, if people want to live in a new home, an insulated home that's in a nice area to drive to, and there's no options, that greenfield sites where there's new estates, they're going to be popular. So surely this is about meeting demand.
But there we've got to think about holding some of these ideas together. So if the population is steady and the population is housed, we're allowing more homes to be built in greenfield sites, it inevitably follows that it's the older housing that gets abandoned. And that's what we're seeing in the centre of towns. So as more people move out of town, so more and more sites are being flattened as temporary car parks for people to drive in from their out-of-town housing to Douglas. There is an absence of modern, pleasant town housing into the centre of the population. Mm. And we've got to think of where the heck does that take us in the longer term?
But that's because it's more expensive, isn't it? It's more expensive for me, if I'm a developer, to say, to redevelop a site in the middle of Douglas with the planning requirements, etc., than it is to, like you said, build a field on Camlaurk.
That's right. So that's back to why we have planning rather than being entirely an open market. Mm. Government has to use its processes to make it more difficult, more expensive to build out of town, and use its resources to encourage and make it more possible to build in town and revitalise our towns. Mm. If we think of where we're going with the whole area of conservation, of sustainability, and us using energy less just for moving ourselves around in little boxes, it surely makes sense that we have to think of how do we make centres of town where people can live, walk, exist, bicycle, walk to work and to the facilities round, rather than having to get in a car to do your weekly shop because you've got nothing nearby you. It doesn't make sense. So it's always for us been certainly an interest of the area where we've lived, but more importantly, it's about important issues for the island and planning as to where we're going.
Well, let's bring this back then. I mean, if you both had a magic wand on the area plan, what would you do? Would you start again?
I don't think we need to start again. I think to be fair, the planning inspector, I think, did look very carefully at all the points that were raised and came up with a fairly reasonable plan, apart from the numbers and the extent of the areas that he has granted development approval for, essentially. And I think that's where we would probably want to see the plan reviewed in terms of the overall numbers of dwellings that would be proposed.
I think it'd be fair here as well to sort of say how much support we've received from RMHK Bill Shimmons and how much we've tried to support him, particularly in his move to bring on and promote the redevelopment of brownfield sites. But the nature of the resolution going to Tynwald is it can only be approved or rejected.
Yeah, there's no debate, is there?
And they can't. It's not subject to any amendment. Mm. So we would say, yeah, great as far as it's gone, but we would say to our representatives, be very aware that the wriggle room that's still permitted into this in the future, and be prepared to hold the policymakers and Council of Ministers to account for the future, that is really important, that we still promote our island into sustainability, into keeping it as a pleasant place to live, not just a pleasant place to drive between.
Would you support some sort of backdoor way of potentially revisiting the plan and changing some of the figures and the estimates to make it more, well, based on perhaps the census next year?
I think it's very, very difficult, Ewan, because the plan approves a number of sites. It doesn't put them in any hierarchy, unlike the strategic reserve sites, which effectively are in some form of hierarchy. So to review the whole plan, I think, would mean going back to the whole
drawing board
to the whole planning inquiry process, and I'm not sure that would be possible. But as I say, we just hope that we will be able to raise issues with the elected members, because bear in mind that a lot of the work that's been done and a lot of the figures that are produced for this plan will be applied for the north and the west, and I think that's something that the elected members for those areas need to be very, very aware of, and the problems that it could bring forward.
Mm. Well, let's contextualise this if we can. The plan as adopted would go into Tynwald. If I'm listening to this and I haven't really followed the area plan issue to its fullest extent, what's the sort of message? I mean, is it to pay attention and be wary of, like you've mentioned, the north and the west? What wisdom would you impart from your sort of experience of the area plan, if you like, and why is it so crucial that people follow this issue and others like it?
First of all, in terms of where we go to from here, Bill Shimmons is actively trying to gain support for delaying the acceptance until the new data is in. Because, you know, we're rational people and we say, let's base stuff on data and information rather than sheer guesswork. Now, don't know if that's going to succeed onto that. It's as it is, it's for our representatives to decide onto that. It's always will be an active, important debate for all of us on the island as to how we preserve and enhance what we have and try to avoid it.
Do you think people recognise they need to get involved at this stage, though? I mean, anecdotally, we hear about a lot of people who maybe don't follow the area plan processes, but when the development starts, they get very angry indeed, and they aren't necessarily engaging when it counts.
Knowing the amount of work that we've put into this one site, it is incredibly difficult for somebody to pick up and understand the process, first of all, and then to be sufficiently well-versed in all the planning legislation and the processes to actually to be able to put a case against development. But I would say that it is natural for anybody to be interested in their own backyard, shall we say. And if there are sites coming forward that are proposed for development, then yes, they should get involved. They should take part. Mm. It may be that they would support that development. And we're saying that you know, why not? In certain areas, it may be appropriate. But in the case of Camlork, we have a very viable farm. We have some of the best land in the Isle of Man on that farm. And why would you want to sacrifice that for concrete?
Is there anything we haven't raised, gentlemen? Sorry,
I think the other message is one that Ken picked up on earlier, is that there are other area plans to come forward. Mm. And it's really important that, although it seems very abstract and so much in the future and who cares, it is quite crucial that each of those area plans really does represent what the people in the area would like to see for the longer term future, because everything will go down from that. Mm. So you need to take an interest, get involved, get yourself together and talk about it and contribute to the future for the island.
John Kermode and Ken Kinraid there of the Save Camlork campaign. You're listening to Agenda on Manx Radio. MHKs could see their basic salaries climb from £43,000 to £65,000 next week if Tynwald approves a report on politicians' pay. It's billed as a cost-neutral move, though, as the lump sum for tax-free expenses will be scrapped, as well as the uplift for joining a department. MLCs would also see their pay go down if the independent report's recommendations are approved. The salary change would not lead to an increase in pensionable pay for members either. The MHK moving the report admits there's never a good time to raise the issue. Ewan Watterson told me the proposed changes won't cost the taxpayer more.
One of the things that we really don't want to do in Tynwald is vote on our own pay. It's something that it only ever brings everybody pain. But it was something that came out of Liz Fain. They said there should be an review. Tynwald told us to go off and do an independent review. That was commissioned, and Ian Cochrane and his team have done a report. As you can imagine, there are as many views on members' pay as there are members of the public, never mind members of Tynwald. But that's the report that we bring. We would have obviously brought it about 6 months ago, but just as COVID was about to hit was when we were due to bring this forward and debate it. So we are just bringing forward the independent report that was suggested by Liz Fain, commissioned by Tynwald, and then we bring it forward in the exact form that it's been produced by Ian and the team.
Is now the right time, considering what everyone's going through?
Never a right time. The important principles of it are that it was going to be cost neutral to the taxpayer, and that was one of the stipulations set down by Tynwald when it commissioned this, and the report that's been produced does that.
You mentioned cost neutral to the taxpayer. Explain the system, because people see that basic salary rise up to £65,000. There are other things going on. Can you try and break it down?
Yeah, we've got a really sort of quite a complicated pay structure at the moment, which means you get paid more depending on what job you do. So the basic pay is something of a misnomer, really, because nobody actually earns that basic pay. There are then a 30% uplift if you're a member of a department. There's a 50% uplift if you're a minister, a 60% uplift if you're the speaker, 80% uplift if you're the chief minister. So all of these different uplifts you are added on. And then on top of that, there's this bizarre £7,000 element, which was introduced in the early 80s as a tax-free lump sum for generic expenses, so that members don't actually claim expenses for things. They just get this amount in their pay, and it's for all the things that they need to run, whatever it might be in the constituency. So this is the pay deal so far. So clearly, having any element of tax-free pay is just completely unacceptable in the modern day and age. So what is happening is that is getting just rolled into salary so that members will be taxed on it going forward. It also changes a lot of this sort of plus 30%, plus 50%, and a lot of that just disappears by being sort of rolled into basic pay. So people who are focusing more on scrutiny roles would get the basic pay, and so will people in a government department, because the acknowledgement is that people should be rewarded for doing the scrutiny work as well as the departmental work. Ministers will still be getting paid a bit more. Presiding officers will get paid a bit more. Most people will actually see a slight reduction. So people like the role of the speaker goes down by £2,000. The chief minister comes down by about £800. But overall, the package is a cost neutral package. No one in the current house will either be any better or worse off, because this only starts coming in next September after the election. So in terms of the only potential winner in the House of Keys really would have been Chris Robertshaw, as the only member not in a government department until recently. And, of course, he said he's not standing, so there is no uplift there.
Would it have been cost neutral if you got a whole new Keys and the majority decided they did not want to be members of departments, although that's unlikely? Wouldn't this mean it wouldn't be cost neutral if that were to be approved?
Well, in terms of cost neutral budget, yes, that would be the theoretical circumstance. I think what you find is when members get elected, they really want to roll their sleeves up, get involved in as many things as they can.
But is that because there's money in it?
No, I don't think it is. I absolutely don't think it is. When people stand for the House of Keys or indeed Legislative Council, they want to make a difference to the people of the Isle of Man. I think people out there in the public can see through people pretty quickly if they think they're going into the politics for the money. And they don't get the votes. The people who get in are the people who are dedicated and really want to make that difference. And so I don't think the money is a big difference. Where I do think it has proved tricky in the past is there have been accusations from members that obviously if you don't vote with the government, you can be sacked from your government department and that can lead to a big fall in your pay. So this does remove that element of patronage, for want of a better expression, from the Chief Minister going forward, and it makes the system far clearer, far simpler, and as I say, it removes the tax-free element, which is just unjustifiable.
Well, should it be approved, would that see maybe next administration more people taking the scrutiny role more seriously if the pay is the same?
I think people do see the scrutiny role, take the scrutiny role seriously. I do think, though, from my experience sitting as chairman of the Public Accounts Committee and seeing the work of the scrutiny committees, I think that there is still, it comes second often to the work of government departments. And I think that it says something about how we value work, because we pay for the government department work, we don't pay for the scrutiny work. So that does come second very often. But that hopefully will mean a bit of a rebalancing of the culture. I obviously am a great believer and a great fan of the mixed way that we do things, where people can take an active part in government and can also take part in scrutiny. I think that's really healthy. I think it's a great apprenticeship for those who are going to go on and be ministers, but also a great toe in the water for those who want to do more in terms of scrutiny. So I think at the moment we have a system that's the best of both worlds. It's just about valuing that in both ways. And that's certainly been the what the committee has produced, the independent report has produced.
Now, it's not your report, you are moving it in Tynwald. Do you support it?
I do support it. And so we've sat around in the Emoluments Committee, which is quite a big committee, and needless to say, there's as many views on it as there are members. So it's not the report that I'd have sat down and written had I been the one writing it, but I think we've all recognised that it has its different strengths and weaknesses. But Tynwald has asked for this report. I think it's only fair that Tynwald get the report unadulterated and get the opportunity to vote on it. I think if we had a blank sheet of paper on members' pay and we had the two options, which are what we have now and what we have in the report, the committee was absolutely unanimous that what this report delivers is better than what we have at the moment.
Do you think those who might not be in favour will point to all politicians shouldn't get more money, despite what you've set out here, in the debate in future, perhaps?
Well, I'd say I can't see that anyone's going to get more money out of this.
But can you see how some might capitalise on that misunderstanding to get the report thrown out?
I'd like to think, members have had two opportunities to quiz the team who put this report. If there are any misunderstandings in the House, they're more likely to be, they're not likely to be accidental misunderstandings. I will give you that.
Very diplomatic. Now, in all the things Liz Fain came forward, the cynics might say, how come one of the few that did get adopted was changes to pay?
I don't know. Liz Fain's report, I think, was fundamentally flawed. I don't think the idea of getting somebody who's been on the island 2 weeks to write a report about our constitution was a good thing to do. But
people say that every time Tynwald commissions someone off island or an independent to do something, if they don't like the results, they can claim, oh, they're not Manx, they don't understand the system.
Then that's absolutely right. I think we've seen some good reports where people have come from off island, have understood the problems, and Jonathan Michael is a good example of that. But equally, people from off island are just as capable of producing reports where they don't capture the views of Tynwald. And bear in mind that all the recommendations of Liz Fain have been discussed, debated and voted on by Tynwald. This was one of the ones that hung over, and it's something that is being delivered. I think members have realised that there is an issue with the pay structure here. There's never a good time to deal with it. Nobody really wants to stand up and debate members' pay, because, as I say, it's only ever a bad news story. No matter, I'm sure if we all decided to cut our pay, I'm sure someone would still find a way of twisting it so that we would be seen to be doing otherwise. This is not the point, and that's why it's really important that this is a cost-neutral exercise. It has been from the start. It will not cost the taxpayer any more money. It really is just a change in the emphasis of how things are done. It introduces some things that members wanted, such as a differential between the members of the House of Keys and the members of the Legislative Council.
You're earning less under this, is that correct?
Under the proposals, the members of the Legislative Council would earn less than members of the House of Keys as a basic salary, yes. So there are these sort of things that were brought up, were considered by the review panel, and will be taken forward if the report finds favour.
Speaker of the House of Keys, Ewan Watterson. That's all from this programme. We'll be back with more from Agenda soon. And you can listen again to this edition online via the Manx Radio website or through Spotify. But for now, Gurumayu and goodbye.